We're continuing on in our studies of the life of Samuel. We're now here on chapter 14, and we're beginning to look at this chapter, starting with verses 1 to 4. Of course, this is an outline in which Samson has requested a wife from his parents, and the reason he has done that is because in the days of Samson, the parents actually arranged the marriages, and it's still done today in other cultures, but not in the United States and other places. It's pretty much a dead issue. But nonetheless, Samson makes a request. Now, this is verses 1 to 4 of Judges 14. Now, the parents were very reluctant and unwilling, really, in the beginning to carry out such a request. That's why in verse 3, the mother and father say to Samson, "Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren, or among all the people? Why do you got to go after the uncircumcised, you know, the Philistines? Why do you got to go after them? Man, you can't find anyone in Israel?" So they were really hesitant. But Samson was, unfortunately, for some reason, this young man was indulgent, self-indulgent, really. And it's amazing, but nonetheless, this is where we are in the story. But I want to read to you now that what happens. And this first statement here is coming from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 563. And the second from Signs of the Times, October the 6th, 1881. Listen to what Sister White says relative to this issue of Samson wanting to marry, and actually did marry, a Philistine. She says, "How many are pursuing the same course as did Samson? How often marriages are formed between the godly and the ungodly, because inclination governs the selection of husband or wife. The parties do not ask counsel of God, nor have his glory in view. Christianity ought to have a controlling influence upon the marriage relation, but it is too often the case that the motives which lead to this union are not in keeping with Christian principles. Satan is constantly seeking to strengthen his power over the people of God by inducing them to enter into alliance with his subjects. And in order to accomplish this, he endeavors to arouse unsanctified passions in the heart. But the Lord has in his word plainly instructed his people not to unite themselves with those who have not his love abiding in them." And then, of course, she quotes 2 Corinthians 6, 15 and 16. Of course, being unequally yoked together with unbelievers, etc., or what union. And that, by the way, that statement is taken from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 563. So here's an unholy union, unholy, ungodly marriage that Samson's entering into. And we are explicitly commanded by God not to enter into union with unbelievers. Now, I know some people say, "Well, I know of experiences where my husband or my wife was, when I married her, wasn't a believer, and then she became a believer." Well, you better count your blessings. Let me first of all say that. And that's the exception to the rule. That's not the rule. In other words, that's not what God says. In other words, that doesn't justify disobeying what God has said in his word. You know, you should be very careful entering into union with unbelievers, whether it be through marriage or business or otherwise. We are clearly told in his word how we should conduct ourselves accordingly. So as far as I'm concerned, dear friends, we should not be in union with unbelievers in marriage, regardless of what you may believe to be the outcome or the experience of others had in regard to this issue. Too often the case has been the opposite of those stories you might hear that say, "Oh, well, everything worked out fine." You're taking a big, big risk. Let me put it to you that way. A big risk. Signs of the Times, October the 6th, 1881. Sister White says, "The Lord has in his word plainly instructed his people not to unite themselves with those who have not his love or fear before them. Such companions will seldom be satisfied with the love and respect which are justly theirs. They will constantly seek to gain from the God-fearing wife or husband some favor, which will involve a disregard of divine requirements." Because, you see, what happens, dear friends, is the godly husband or wife doesn't want to do what the unbeliever wants to do. The unbeliever will keep hounding and hounding and hounding that person to finally compromise. And in a lot of cases, that's what happens. I tell you, I know of people who've married. One husband, he just caves in to the will of the wife, no matter what she might have to say. You know, look, dear friend, you got to be careful. Playing with fire, again, it's a very dangerous thing. Again, Signs of the Times, October the 6th, 1881. It is not safe for Christians to imitate the example of the ungodly or to yield to their influence. The wisest counsels of the wicked are not to be relied upon. Did you catch that? Let me repeat that again. The wisest counsels of the wicked are not to be relied upon. See, when the Bible says where there's a multitude of counselors, there's safety, that's not talking about a multitude of counselors among the wicked or a part of the group being wicked and righteous. It's meaning the multitude of counselors are all godly. She goes on to say, if accepted, meaning the wise counsels of the wicked, they may bring trouble and sorrow upon the children of God. The Lord would not have his people take ungodly persons into their confidence. Did you catch that one? Friend, beware who you unite with, because let me tell you, when you marry an unbeliever, or you're in business with an unbeliever, and you start confiding in them about certain things, they're not controlled by the Spirit of God. They don't love him, and that means, dear friends, they're under the power of Satan, which means, dear friends, let me tell you this, they're going to use what you say to them in a confidential manner against you one day. You better beware. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 563, she says this, at his marriage feast, Samson was brought into familiar association with those who hated the God of Israel. Whoever voluntarily enters into such relations will feel it necessary to conform to some degree to the habits and customs of his companions. So when you marry an unbeliever and you enter into this union with them, you're going to feel compelled to some degree to compromise. And that's another reason that brought Samson down to the level he was at. She goes on to say, the time thus spent is worse than wasted. Thoughts are entertained and words are spoken that tend to break down the strongholds of principle and to weaken the citadel of the soul. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 563. And so you see, dear friends, Samson here makes requests to marry an unbeliever. His parents, unfortunately, gave in to the request, and as a result, this was another disastrous step for Samson. Slowly, one by one, Samson was compromising his way to ruin. Sad to say, but that's a fact. Now, this, of course, leads us to another section now. Now, in verses 5 to 7, this is the story where Samson slays a lion. A miraculous event, no doubt about it. By the way, which is very interesting, he goes down to the vineyards. This is in verse 5. It says, then went Samson down, and his father and his mother, to Timnath. And he came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion was there. And that's, of course, when he slays the lion. But what's interesting is the vineyards. You're going to see this picked up a little bit later on in the subject as well. But Samson was given, unfortunately, to the indulgence of wine. Again, violation of his Nazarite vow. But that's where it goes. You start compromising one by one. This is what happens. And then, of course, another compromise you'll see here in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 14, where Samson, he was walking, and there he saw, and starts in verse 8, as he was returning, he saw a carcass of a lion. And there were swarms of bee and honey in the carcass. So what does he do? He grabs the honey. He starts eating it. Came to his father and mother and he gave it to them. But the Bible says he told them not that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. Now why didn't he tell them? Now think about that difference. Why didn't Samson tell his mother and father where he got the honey from? Because, dear friends, The honey came from the carcass of a lion. The lion is an unclean animal. It's a violation of the Nazarite vow. It's unclean honey. And Samson didn't tell him because he knew full well. If they knew where it came from, they wouldn't have eaten it. You know, this is a rather interesting story here. Now, Samson had been compromising little by little, step by step, until he actually caused his parents to eat something that was unclean. And frankly, he didn't even care. He didn't even care. You know, it's one thing for you, if you want to do something that's wrong, that's one thing. But for you to become an instrument in the hands of Satan, to cause the very ones that you're supposed to love more than life itself to go do something that's wrong, that's another story altogether. And by the way, just as a footnote on this, of course, Manoah and his wife, you know, Samson's parents, they weren't, held accountable for this. They didn't know. They had no knowledge of this, where it came from. They wouldn't have eaten it, believe me, had they known where it came from. But it just shows you how far Samson has fallen. how far down the path he has gone, that he didn't even care that what he was about to give to his parents would cause them to be eating something he knew was wrong, unclean. Boy, that really is a terrible situation. So that's where you pick up the story there in verses 8 and 9. Then finally we come to verses 10 to 14. This is Samson's marriage feast and the riddle he gives based on the experience of the lion and the honey. And so, you know, he goes down, of course, and he has a feast. This is the marriage ceremony and everything. And, of course, Samson puts forth this riddle. He says, well, if you can tell me, you can guess the answer. He said, I'll give you 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments. Of course, Samson, in the end, he declares the riddle to his wife there in verse 15. So what's interesting here, this is actually very similar to the experience that would happen to him when he is with Delilah. Because the men of the Philistines came to his wife and said, get him to tell us the riddle, the answer, tell us so we can know. And listen to what it says in verse 16. As Samson's wife wept before him and said, thou dost but hate me and lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle unto the children of my people and hast not told it me. And so here she says, you know, Samson, you really don't love me. You really don't care about me. Because, you know, if you did, Samson, you would have told me the answer to the riddle. Now, she's a conniving operator. She's manipulative. And by the way, Delilah was the same way. Unfortunately, Samson, you know, once you start down that path of temptation and you start yielding step by step, step by step, your resistance to temptation is going to be lessened. And Samson eventually told her, because in verse 17, you see, she wept before him 7 days. And so finally he tells him the riddle. So she then relays it to the children of the Philistines, and they tell him the riddle. Now, he knows, of course, that he's been lied to, he's been deceived, he's been misled as a result. And, of course, this is where the story picks up in verses 15 to 20. And, of course, as a result, it says in verse 19, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and slew 30 men of them and took their spoils and gave change of garments unto them, which expounded the riddle. So he kept his word, at least he gave the garments. He was a man of that, at least in that regard, integrity. But he was really angry and upset, betrayed. And so he left his wife for a while. Now, this is a very interesting, because we're coming up to chapter 15. So Samson leaves his wife and, you know, needs some time to himself. Now, we're not really told how long of a time, but nonetheless, it was some time. In the meantime, though, when you come to chapter 15, and we pick up the story here in verses 1 and 2, Samson returns, but when he returns to his wife, her father gives Samson's wife to his best man in the marriage feast. And so his wife has been given away. And this, of course, just absolutely puts him, he's distraught. I mean, let's put it this way. He is absolutely distraught. In verses 3 to 5, Samson seeks his revenge. So what does he do? He takes 300 foxes and he puts 5 brands and to their tails and basically links them up. And he sets them in the midst of the Philistines' cornfields and vineyards and olives and so forth. And what happens is a great disaster, a carnage of a fire that burns up the crops. This is verses 3 to 5. As a result of that, the Philistines seek their revenge by killing Samson's wife in verse 6. And then Samson, in verses 7 and 8, he seeks revenge. And he goes and slaughters, with a great slaughter, it says, to avenge his wife's death. And, of course, as a result of this, and that's verses 7 and 8, Samson flees. And the Philistines then go to the men of Judah, because that's where Samson flees to. And basically tells them, look, you go hunt him down and bring him back to us. And so Samson is pursued eventually by 3,000 of the children of Judah, and he's bound and delivered to the Philistines. Now, of course, there's an agreement made with Samson and the men of Judah, saying, look, I'll go with you as long as you promise me you won't kill me. And of course, that's what they agree to do. They're more than happy to abide by that. But in verses 14 to 17, what happens is they bind him up and pass him off to the Philistines. But the Lord comes upon Samson, and what does he find? He breaks the cords, and he finds the jawbone of an ass. And it's a new jawbone, by the way, and that's very interesting because if it had been an older one, it would be brittle. And this was a new jawbone of an ass, and with it, he kills 1,000 men. He slays them. This is a slaughter. And I want you to listen to what Sister White now says about this. This is taken from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 564, about this one issue. Now, please listen to this. This is so important. Had the Israelites been ready to unite with Samson and follow up the victory? So here was this great victory. He slays 1,000 men. The Philistines have fled. And so had the Israelites been ready to unite with Samson to follow up the victory, they might have at this time freed themselves from the power of their oppressors. But they had become dispirited and cowardly. They had neglected the work which God commanded them to perform in dispossessing the heathen and had united with them in their degrading practices, tolerating their cruelty, and so long as it was not directed against themselves, even countenancing their injustice. When themselves brought under the power of the oppressor, they tamely submitted to the degradation which they might have escaped had they only obeyed God. Even when the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, they would not infrequently desert him and unite with their enemies. Here was a golden opportunity for the children of Israel to unite with Samson, and they could have overthrown the captivity of the Philistines. But because they were compromising, timid, afraid, they dare not. Now what's interesting, they had conditioned themselves living in this state of slavery, as it were, that they weren't willing to rise up. It's a very interesting sociological study here when you think about human behavior. They had so conditioned themselves to live in a deplorable state that they had browbeaten themselves into submission. That when someone like Samson came along and gave them a golden opportunity to set themselves free, they weren't willing to set themselves free. They weren't willing to pay the price because they had compromised themselves into submission. You know, I think there are so many people in the church today who don't realize how important it is to have moral courage, moral integrity. You know, when the crisis breaks, are you going to stand? Here was a golden opportunity for the children of God, yet they still would not obey, even after such a great victory. Friends, let me tell you, there are many God-fearing people out there today wanting to do the will of God. But dear friends, they've come to a point where they've compromised their way. There are those in the church who have just so far compromised, they're not willing to unite with the God-fearing, even after they demonstrate that God is with them. You know, we need to really pray and ask God to lead us along the way. Well, we continue on here in chapter 15, in the final section here, verses 18 to 20. Samson is athirst, and then he's made, of course, judge over Israel. And I want you to listen to what Sister White says about him and his thirst. So he's exhausted. He's really tired after this victory. She says this, thousands of Israelites witnessed Samson's defeat of the Philistines, yet no voice was raised in triumph, till the hero, elated at his marvelous success, celebrated his own victory. But he praised himself instead of ascribing the glory to God. No sooner had he ceased than he was reminded of his weakness by a most intense and painful thirst. He had become exhausted by his prodigious labors, and no means of supplying his need was at hand. He began to feel his utter dependence upon God, to be convinced that he had not triumphed by his own power, but in the strength of the Omnipotent One. He then gave God the praise for his deliverance and offered an earnest prayer of relief for his present suffering. The Lord hearkened to his petition and opened for him a spring of water. In token of his gratitude, Samson called the name of the place In Hakor, or the well of him that cried. After this victory, the Israelites made Samson judge over them, and he ruled Israel for 20 years. Now, what I thought was interesting here is the fact that, you know, here's Samson, he has this great victory. He takes the glory, and then the Lord allows this great sore, or, you know, very great exceeding thirst to come upon him, reminding him, Samson, You may be strong, but you're not that strong. And of the strength that you had to gain the victory, it was because of God, me, he was saying, not you, Samson. And he reminded him that he is but a man, and he's not superhuman, and he's not divine. You know, sometimes the Lord allows us to fall into these unfortunate set of circumstances, not that he causes it, but he allows it, to remind us of who we really are. Sometimes, dear friends, we need to realize how thirsty, you know, we really are of God. In other words, we need him, that he is our strength, he's our deliverer, he's the one who can guide us and help us along the way. And so the Lord was reminding Samson, I'm the reason you have the victory. I'm the reason you are successful in this regard. So it's a very, very wonderful, wonderful statement. Now we come to the last chapter, chapter 16 of the story here of Judges. In Judges 1-3, Samson's unlawful passion. Once again, what do we find him doing? Well, he goes down to Gaza, and there he sees a harlot. He wants to go see to a place of prostitution. So listen to what Sister White says now. I want you to listen very carefully. Signs of the Times, October 13, 1881. One wrong step prepares the way for another. Samson had transgressed the command of God by taking a wife from the daughters of the Philistines, and ere long, he ventured again among that people, now his deadly enemies, and in the indulgence of his unlawful passions, trusting confidently to his great strength, which had inspired the Philistines with such terror, he boldly entered Gaza, one of the largest and most powerful cities, and visited a harlot of that place. The disgraceful fact was soon made known to the inhabitants of the city, who were eager to be avenged upon their dreadful foe. Fearing to attack him, however, they sent for reinforcements and kept a vigilant watch at the gate of the city, determined by some means to put him to death in the morning. At midnight, Samson was aroused. The accusing voice of conscience filled him with remorse as he remembered that he had broken his vow as a Nazarite. But despite his sin, God's mercy had not forsaken him. His great strength again served to deliver him. Wrenching the city gate from its place, he took it entire, with its post and bars, and carried it several miles to the top of the hill on the way to Hebron, and the guards, meanwhile, being too much surprised, terrified to intercept or pursue him. She then says, but even this narrow escape did not serve to stay him from his evil course. The third step downward soon followed the second. One wrong step after the other, one after the other. You know, here he is, he picks up this gate, I mean, post and all, carries the thing, the entire gate on his shoulders, and several miles, mind you, and plants the thing on top of a hill. Unbelievable, but still, I mean, it's a miracle of God. I mean, when you consider what he was doing, I mean, playing with temptation. But you know, I tell you, through this all story, this whole story, you really see God's patience and love for Samson. Despite his many failings, it really teaches me, you know, God doesn't give up. He just doesn't give up on us. Boy, dear friends, what a merciful, compassionate God we serve. And then, of course, it continues on in Judges 16, verses 4 and 5. He meets Delilah. I want you to now listen to the servant of the Lord. I'm going to read two statements from Signs of the Times, October 13, 1881. Sister White says, he did not again venture into the territory of the Philistines, but sought at home those sensuous pleasures that were luring him on to the ruin. He loved the woman in the Vale of Sirach. Her name was Delilah, which fitly signifies consuming or wasting. In the society of this enchantress, the judge of Israel squandered precious hours that should have been sacredly devoted to the welfare of his people. But the blinding passions which make even the strongest weak had gained control of reason and conscience. The Vale of Sirach, a little valley not far from his own birthplace, was celebrated for its vineyards. These also had a temptation for the wavering Nazarite, who had already indulged in the use of wine, thus breaking another tie that bound him to temperance, to purity, and to God. And so this is the reason. So he didn't go to the land of Philistines. He went to a place right next to him. But one of the reasons, of course, was because of the vineyards, the wine. He had already given indulgence to drinking alcohol. Well, he was now going to gratify his desires. Continue on, she goes, says this in the same article, and another part of the article, she says, the Philistines were well acquainted with the divine law and its condemnation of sensual indulgence. They kept a vigilant watch over all the movements of their enemy. And when he, Samson, degraded himself by this new attachment. They saw the bewitching power of the enchantress. They determined through her to accomplish his ruin. Now, friend, let me tell you something. Our enemies are watching us. You can better believe they are well acquainted with the requirements of God. Satan knows exactly what God says, and he knows exactly who's playing with sin. And friends, he's going to arrange things in such a way to cause you to fall, and in some cases come to utter ruin. And so Samson meets this woman, and the Philistines realize, you know what? We'll get him. We'll conquer him, but not in the battlefield, but in the field of temptation. And so verses 6 to 14, of course, Samson meets Delilah. And now Delilah is bribed by the Philistines to discover Samson's strength. They want to know the secret. Why is this man so powerful? So Delilah asks Samson to reveal his secret. And Samson deceives Delilah 3 times. The first time, verses 6 through 10, he says, you know, if you bind me with 7 green cords, they'll take my strength away. And of course, that's what happens. She cries out at midnight, Samson, your enemies have come. And he, of course, breaks the 7 cords. Of course, she then feels betrayed. She then complains, and again, the second time, you know, tell me your secret. And of course, in verses 10 to 12, he says, well, you have to use new ropes, never used before. If you bind me with that, I'll lose my strength. Of course, that doesn't work. Again, she comes a third time, this time in verses 13 or 14. And he says, well, you got to weave 7 locks of my hair, like a web, weave it together, and I'll have no strength. Of course, that fails as well. What's interesting, though, on the third time, he does reveal partial truth, that his hair has to do with his strength. Now, he doesn't reveal everything. But what's interesting, dear friends, is when you start to play with temptation, and you start to compromise your way, eventually, you're going to compromise your way to tell maybe not the whole truth, at least at some point, but you'll tell partial truth. And if you keep getting pushed, you'll eventually tell the truth. And that's exactly what happened to Samson. Samson was actually told Delilah the truth of the matter. Listen to this. The Signs of the Times, October 13, 1881. Samson's infatuation seems almost incredible. At first, he was not wholly enthralled as to reveal the secret. So he wasn't all that excited about revealing it. But he had deliberately walked into the net of the betrayer of souls, and its meshes were drawing closer about him every step. 3 times he had the clearest evidence that the Philistines had leagued with his charmer to destroy him. So 3 times he had clear evidence that Delilah was betraying him to his enemy. You would think that would have woke him up. The Sister White goes on to say this, but when her purpose failed and his strength returned, she had treated the matter as a jest. Now, she was sly as a dog. Listen very carefully. She was sly. So when she got caught, she just laughed it off. Oh, you know, like it was just nothing. It was a joke. Oh, I wasn't all that serious. Oh, no. I was just kidding with you. Why? Why did she do that? To disarm him. Did you catch that? She then goes on to say, Sister White, and he blindly banished all fear of danger. That was the result. Oh, I was just kidding with you. He was highly suspicious. He knew something was wrong. 3 times he was given evidence that she had betrayed him to his enemy. And when she got caught, I was just kidding with you, Samson. Oh, don't take it too serious. And what did he do? He blindly banished all fear of danger. Man, oh man. She goes on to say this, though. Day by day, Delilah pressed and urged him until his soul was vexed unto death. Yet a subtle power kept him by her side. Man, she was driving him crazy about this secret. He was given clear evidence she was a betrayer. Yet a subtle power kept Samson by the side of Delilah. He was infatuated with her beauty. He was infatuated with the sensual passions of the flesh. She goes on to say, Sister White, her heart was set upon the tempting bribe, and she exerted all her blandishments to secure it. She was going to get wealthy. She had an ulterior motive. She didn't love Samson. Overcome at last by the bewitching spell, which he seemed to have no power to break, Samson made known the secret. And so finally, verses 15 to 22, Samson reveals the dark secret of his strength. This is the downfall of Samson. This is what's going to bring him down. In Signs of the Times, October 13, 1881, Sister White says this. Now, mind you, now look, he's caught, right? He finally tells her, Delilah, his secret of his strength is his hair, because he had taken a Nazarite vow. It had never been cut since he was born. And so she causes him to sleep on her lap and cuts his hair. Sure, she doesn't do it. She has someone else to come and cut his hair. And then wakes him up, and he's powerless. He has no power. The Philistines capture him. They put out his eyes. And he is now a captive, a slave of the Philistines. Listen to what Sister White says now. What a change to him that had been the judge and champion of Israel. Now weak, blind, and in prison, degraded to the most menial service, little by little he had violated the conditions of his sacred calling. God had borne long with him, but when he had so yielded himself to the power of sin as to betray his secret, that moment God departed from him. There was no virtue in the length of his hair in itself, but it was a token of his loyalty to God. And when the symbol was sacrificed to the indulgence of lustful passion, the blessings of which it was a token were also forfeited. Had Samson's head been shaven without fault on his part, his strength would have remained. But his course had shown contempt for the favor and authority of God as much as if he had disdained himself, severed his locks from his head. Therefore God left him to endure the results of his own folly. In his sufferings and humiliation, a sport for the Philistines, Samson had opportunity for reflection, and he learned more of his own weakness they had never known before. As his afflictions led him to repentance, his hair began gradually to grow, indicating the return of his extraordinary powers, but his enemies, regarding him only as a fettered and helpless prisoner, felt no apprehensions. Now, it's a sad, really, commentary when you think about Samson and what happened to him. But here's the thing, and this is the thing we have to remember. You know, thank God Samson came to his senses and repented. I was so thankful to be reminded again of Samson's repentance. You feel so sorry for him in so many ways. And yet, you just feel your heart going out to him. And yet, at the same time, you feel so disappointed and so sad in regard to what might have been. But Samson, little by little, violated the will of God, and now he's a prisoner. But, thank God, a repentant one. And finally, we come down to the last part, the last section, verses 23 to 31. And this, of course, is the Philistines have a feast for Dagon, the fish god. And what is interesting here is that they exalt their god above the God of Israel. In other words, instead of it being the Philistines versus Samson, they now make it Dagon versus Jehovah. And so now it's a different conflict here. So now it's a different issue altogether. What you see here is a shift of focus in regard to the conflict. And so Samson's going to seek his final revenge. And they're having a feast in the temple of Dagon. And Samson is weary. He's asked to be placed in the two pillars, between the two pillars, which is the center holding up all the other pillars. And literally there are thousands of people assembled at this feast, thousands. And of course the story is, we know, he obviously repents of his sins. He had already repented. He asked God to seek revenge on the Philistines. And of course he pushes down the two pillars, which holds up the entire temple. And everything else is collapsed, and they all die in this destruction. I want to listen now in closing. I'm going to read two statements to you from this pen of inspiration. One is from Signs of the Times, October 13, 1881. And the other is Patriarchs and Prophets, page 567. I want you to listen to what Servant Lord says. As the Philistines exulted over their great victory, they ascribed the honor to their gods, praising them as superior to the God of Israel. The contest, instead of being between Samson and the Philistines, was now between Jehovah and Dagon. And thus the Lord was moved to assert his almighty power and his supreme authority. A favorable opportunity for this was soon presented. The Philistines held a feast in honor of their god Dagon. A vast company was assembled, and in the height of their sacrilegious festivities, they ordered the captive to be produced, that the people might have a new source of amusement. The multitude greeted his appearance with shouts of triumph and praised their God, who had thus subdued the destroyer of their country. Samson had been made the sport of the people before, but now even the rulers of the nation mocked his misery. The immense building was thronged with brave and the fair, even the roof crowded with thousands of spectators. After a time, as if weary, Samson asked permission to rest against the two central pillars which supported the temple roof. Then he breathed the prayer, O Lord Jehovah, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes. With these words he seized the pillars in his mighty arms, and with the cry, Let me die with the Philistines, he bowed himself, and the roof fell, destroying at one dread crash all that vast company, so that the dead which he slew at his death was more than they which he slew in life. Signs of the Times, October 13, 1881. Very interesting that the great conflict had shifted, but again, you see the mighty Samson coming back, this last victory. He ends on a high note. Now, I know that his life, when you look at chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, you know, you don't see much to glory God in, because his life, for the most part, has been terrible. I mean, there are moments where he's just not a good person. But you see redemption at the end. Now, I want to read this last statement to you. And this, again, comes from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 567 and 568. And I want you to listen to what Sister White says about Samson's life. God's promise that through Samson he would begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines was fulfilled. But how dark and terrible the record of that life which might have been a praise to God and the glory of it to the nation. Had Samson been true to his divine calling, the purpose of God could have been accomplished in his honor and exaltation. But he yielded to temptation and proved untrue to his trust, and his mission was fulfilled in defeat, bondage, and death. Physically, Samson was the strongest man upon the earth, but in self-control, integrity, and firmness, he was one of the weakest of men. Many mistake strong passions for strong character, but the truth is that he who mastered by his passions is a weak man. The real greatness of the man is measured by the power of the feelings that he controls, and not by those that control him. Notice what the real greatness of a man is measured by the power of the feelings that he controls. She goes on to say, God's providential care had been over Samson, that he might be prepared to accomplish the work which he had called him to do. At the very outset of life, he was surrounded with favorable conditions for physical strength, intellectual vigor, and moral purity. But under the influence of wicked associations, he let go that hold upon God, which is man's only safeguard, and he was swept away by the tide of evil. Those who in the way of duty are brought into trial may be sure that God will preserve them. But if men willfully place themselves under the power of temptation, they will fail sooner or later. The very one whom God proposes to use as his instruments for a special work, Satan employs his utmost power to lead astray. He attacks us at our weak points, working through defects in the character to gain control of the whole man. And he knows that if these defects are cherished, he will succeed. But none need be overcome. Man is not left alone to conquer the power of evil by his own feeble efforts. Please listen to this, friends. Please listen. None need be overcome. She goes on to say, help is at hand and will be given to every soul who really desires it. Angels of God that ascend and descend the ladder which Jacob saw in vision will help every soul who will to climb even the highest heaven. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 567 and 568. You know, dear friends, you may say, Ray, you know, I feel so many ways like Samson. I've fallen short in so many ways. Well, you know what? You may have. But let me tell you, there's a God in heaven who loves you and wants you in the kingdom of heaven. And he'll help you. He'll guide you. He'll show you. And most of all, he will forgive you if you'll just ask him. Don't turn your hearts away from the Lord, dear friends. He wants you to be in heaven with him. Samson, his life is an incredible object lesson. A man who failed so many times. And in the end, he did accomplish God's will. Maybe not in the way that God had desired. That's true, no doubt about it. But a man who came to his senses and repented. And in the end, a man who did God's will. You know, dear friends, you and I, we can be overcomers. We can succeed. We can gain the victory. If only we look to God and realize He and He alone is our strength. I hope and pray that in some way this lesson of the life of Samson really helps you to reflect that even though you may have fallen, even though you have given him into temptation, yet this man, despite all his failings, repented of his sins, and the God of heaven forgave him. And that same God can forgive you. He can forgive me. There is redemption, dear friends. There is forgiveness. We serve a loving God, a compassionate God. He's not willing that any should perish, but that we should all come to repentance. And I pray to God, dear friends, that we may take from the life of Samson those lessons that the Lord so longs for us to learn. And in the end, I pray we shall be overcomers. May God bless you and the Lord be with you.